It's that time again for our recap episode of The Last of Us. This time we're going to be talking about episode 2, which dropped in Malaysia on Monday morning. Obviously, there will be plenty of spoilers here, so you have been warned. So with episode 2, the thing that I found most telling with regards to the way this story is being told is how every moment matters. I think one of the things we complain about a lot, I know we're sounding like broken records, but the one thing we most complain about is bloat. And Netflix have been a huge perpetrator of this bloat. And what we mean by bloat is when sometimes a show feels like it doesn't need 12 episodes because there's so much filler in between, and maybe they signed a contract for 12 and just had to come up with enough story to fill 12 hours of programming. Now, the HBO adaptation of The Last of Us, these episodes aren't necessarily short. They range between 45 minutes and some even go for longer than an hour. But that said, it feels like every moment matters. And watching episode 2, I really got this. We stopped episode 1 and they were walking out into the city on a big adventure. And episode 2 did everything it needed to. Like from the prologue in Indonesia, setting up the weight of what was going on in the world, to developing the relationship with Tess, to actually giving them a moment where Joel realizes why Ellie is important and why this mission is important. Because up until this point, Joel is still like, I don't know why she's around. It's not real. It may be a fake out. I don't believe any of this shit. She's getting in my way. I just want a fucking car battery, right? And then by the time episode 2 is done, there is a real sense of emotion between these two people and what they have to do. Also, episode 2 does the great thing of really showing us the bad guys for the first time. And man, is it impactful when that happens.
This is in no way a flex or anything, but like, because we saw it a while back and I saw it in such rapid succession that I took for granted that Joel is protecting Ellie. Rewatching episode 2 when it came out really reminds me that this was not the match made in heaven that I remember it to be. There's a real tension between Joel and the Ellie situation of it all. And again, he just wants a goddamn car battery. All of this for a goddamn car battery, right? And episode 2 sort of, for the first time, really proves to Joel that there's something bigger than just him getting through the day, making a bit of money, and hopefully trying to get his brother. The family aspect of it all is important, sure, but there's a bigger thing at play here, and he is involved in it, right? He's no longer just trying to avoid the bigger arguments between Fedra and the rebels and all that stuff. He's now firmly in place to make a play on this, on these things that are unfolding. And I think episode 2 really sets it down. I think really, really puts you in Joel's headspace.
Yet again, one of the things we spoke about, even when we reviewed the show, was how they paced out the action bits and how the conflict and the confrontations between the humans and the undead, let's call them the undead, I don't know what they are, the fungally infested, whatever you want to call them. The big action fights are quite limited, but I think when they happen, they serve a purpose. And in this case, when we see the clicking monsters for the first time and they're in that room and they're trying to avoid them, you have a real quiet place kind of effect going on, which is truly yep. Terrifying. And that is a small scale representation of what's going to happen at the end of the episode, because when Tess finally dies and when that massive horde starts attacking them, you're introduced to every aspect of these creatures in this one episode. You know exactly how they can attack as individuals and how they work as a horde as well. And I think all of that is a very concise way of laying out the stakes of a show.
For a second episode to introduce you to the clickers, I think in a different show, we'd be disappointed that we only see these fungal things in the second episode. If The Walking Dead spent its entire pilot episode just not showing us zombies, I'd be really annoyed and angry. But here, the fact that they held it back goes a long way in setting out the story, right? And it tells you that the story is more important than just, oh, look, it's zombies.
It's also just very confident storytelling in that...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It trusts us to not get lost. It trusts us to not be bored. It's a weekly drop show as well. That's the thing. It's like...
Yeah.
You know Netflix would do this in episode 3 or 4 because they think people are just going to binge their way through 8 episodes. And so therefore, they're confident in being able to hold this information back because the episodes are there if you want to watch them. Here, there is a fear that someone may drop off. And that fear was completely unfounded because from the statistics, they had a 20% increase, which is apparently the largest audience increase for a HBO show ever from episode 1 to 2. So whatever they're doing it really well. And I think we're a great example of an audience that was hooked in because even after watching episode 1, we were ready. We were primed to wait for the next episode to come. And I think that's just very smart serialized storytelling.
The two things there that you mentioned are actually intertwined, right? The idea that there's trust in the audience, but also there's confidence in the writing because you can't have one without the other. You can misplace trust very easily, right? And I think here they know that what they've done in episode 1, and they know the hype and the branding around the show will keep you coming back to episode 2. But even then, they don't skimp on episode 1. There is so much necessary setup without dragging anything on. Episode 1 could have easily been one of those like unnecessarily long where they're trying to set up everything. In lesser hands, the Jakarta prologue would have been in episode 1, you know. Like they would have gotten all of the flashback stuff out of the way and then suddenly go into this thing. But the way they've set it up, there's all these really interesting drops along the way that make you go, huh, oh, okay. So the trust is there, but also it is carried by good, confident writing.
It's very old school pilot programming, right? Original TV shows back in the network era. I say back in the network era, but yeah, because hardly anyone watches network TV anymore, at least not in Malaysia. Like everyone's just watching streaming stuff. But back in the network era, original programming, writers had a very difficult task. You were given either 24 minutes or 44 minutes or 48 minutes to set up an entire world, and then you move on. There was no option of, I'm going to world build over 10 episodes. The network wouldn't stand for it, right? After that first pilot, 22 episodes of story must follow. And everyone needs to know everything they need to know about the show and the characters in that first episode.
That is exactly what the first episode of Walking Dead did, right? Remember? Because it opens up with what's his name as a standard cop, gets into an accident, goes into a coma, wakes up from the coma, he's in a different world. So there is a quick build of this is where you are. This is what comes next. And you have to take it.
And with The Last of Us, they do it over 2 episodes. That world building is episode 1, introduces to this new world that we're living in. And episode 2 is purely character development between Joel and Ellie and a little bit on what this fungal infested world or creatures are up to. So they set up the world really well. And by doing so, I think you avoid traps like the Deus Ex Machina stuff. You avoid sudden surprises. So the audience won't go, I didn't see that coming. That was such a cheap shot. No, all of the rules have been set up. And so now it's just a matter of following these rules in building your story. And I think all of that is done beautifully. And I can't wait for people to see what comes after because the foundations have been laid out in these 2 episodes. Let's talk about the Jakarta bit very quickly. So obviously, that bit made me very upset because, one, it was so brilliant, and 2, I couldn't see them setting something like that in Malaysia. I just couldn't. I couldn't see them pulling it off, and yet it worked really well with the Indonesian actors. It was just, it was so concise and so tight and so impactful. It was like, what was it, 5 minutes? And you got so much out of it.
Here's my thing. For me, the writers did exceptional job with the Jakarta situation. They could have easily done some other random country. It could have been Taiwan. It could have been KL. They could have easily pulled the Venom in Borneo, Malaysia kind of situation. But the Jakarta thing works on so many levels in that they are one of the world's biggest flour producers, I think it is. So the outbreak happens in a factory in Jakarta that makes flour. Jakarta is also one of the most densely populated cities, places, islands in the world at this point, right? And all of that works. Jakarta isn't some random small place. Jakarta is a big multinational country. It's got international flights coming in and out of it. And I think the Jakarta of it all was perfect for what comes next in The Last of Us. Because this isn't just a, oh, this happened in Kansas, whatever, right? It's beautifully done.
Also, they captured the cultural interaction so well. The way the scientist interacts with the cops, with the general, with the soldiers, all of that was captured perfectly well. It is exactly how people speak. It is not a white person thinking how Asians speak.
I wonder if they actually shot that in Jakarta. Probably not, but
I think it might have been all green screen lah. You don't have to go on location for something like that, right?
No, you don't. You're right. But I think that was enough. They did enough with the Indonesian or Southeast Asian actors in the non-speaking roles to sort of set it up, right? Like when the general walks into the restaurant at the beginning of that sequence, there's enough sort of the right colored people to fill out that shot. And you're right. For me, it's the end of that sequence that really shook me when Christine Hakim says, bomb. Just bomb. Bomb everything.
Yeah, just, there's no
You
option.
Have bombs. Just bomb everything. The general goes, we brought you here to come up with a vaccine or cure. And she's like, nah, bomb. Just bomb everything. I've spent my life researching fungal infections and there's no way out of this. Just bomb everything. And I thought the way she delivered it was beautiful.
Also, the execution of that idea as well, where it wasn't just to show that a virus started in some third world country somewhere. No. The idea was very simple. It's just to show that how everywhere in the world, no matter where you're from, everyone reacted in the same way. The experts all said the same thing.
Mm.
Based on the prologue from the first episode and the prologue on this, yup, sorry, you're going to have to kill your own citizens because there's no turning back from this. And I think that was just very nice.
And it comes back later, right? Because as our trio of protagonists are walking through the town, the city that they're in, you know, Ellie sees a crater and she goes, is this where they dropped the bomb? And I don't think it was Joel. I think it was maybe Tess who say, yeah, that's how they tried to stop it. It worked here. It didn't work in most places. You know, so is this thing of like, yep, that's all they can do. That's all they did. And even then it didn't work.
So to talk about some of the changes, and I think yet again, this episode highlights how smart they were with the changes and how the changes actually served the story really, really well. The first big change, of course, is how the fungally infected operate. So this idea that they are interconnected via this network of nerves, underground things, is new. That wasn't in the game.
Right.
And I think that makes for a very interesting angle, especially when dealing with these creatures, because then it adds a level of collective intelligence, which makes them a far more interesting enemy. It also makes the whole idea of these things coming out of their mouth and infecting you really fucking scary, which is cool, because you don't just lose your mind, but you become part of a hive. And I think that element has always been frightening to humanity in general, this idea of losing your individuality. It's what Star Trek did with the Borg, and which is why that enemy in Star Trek has been so compelling for so many years. They're still making stories about the Borg because it is a truly frightening enemy for humanity, right? And then there is the way Tess dies, which is changed, but not by a lot. So in the game, Tess gets bitten, but she dies at the hands of Fedra. She's shot and killed by Fedra. I think the show makes it far more emotional to have her be bitten to prove that, hey, at least the real deal, Joel, you got to do it. I'm going to die, but I'm going to save you in the process. And then that whole sequence with the bomb and the creature grabbing her and like going in for this evil kiss and then the explosion, like all of that was just so impactful.
I would think in that position, Joel's anger would be directed at Fedra as opposed to these fungal things, right?
So
I think that shifting of the ire of Joel makes it a far more interesting thing because it solidifies the villain that he has in his head. It's not Fedra. Fedra is just a thing that they have to avoid. It's not the revenge thing that he needs to go for.
Yeah.
I've been seeing a lot of comments online on Twitter regarding, shall we just call it the kiss? And yes. How it was unnecessary and a little gratuitous. I was reading an interview with Druckmann, I think it was, and I think his explanation of it is very interesting because we always see in these sort of zombie horde infected type things, the heroes are always, or not heroes, but the victims are always torn apart, right? They're always grabbed and torn and ripped and eaten and shredded and all that stuff. So his question was, what would happen if the victim didn't fight back?
Right.
If the victim didn't resist the oncoming attack, essentially, right? And that would make sense because as a fungal horde thing, why would you rip up a perfectly good body? I mean, the horde doesn't know that Tess has been bitten. They just know that she's given up. So why give up a perfectly good body and rip it apart and eat it and lose that body when you could infect it? It was graphic. It was, I don't know about gratuitous, but it was spine-chilling, I think is what is the word for me. It really was disgusting and yet it made perfect sense.
Yeah, I don't think it was gratuitous at all. I think it was just the kind of shock we needed to show us just how dangerous these things are. And I say that because zombies are boring now. Like when I watch a zombie show, I know exactly what's going to happen. I'm just like, okay, hundreds and thousands of hordes. There's going to be a guy with machine guns mowing them down, or a bomb, or a bazooka, whatever. And they're just not scary anymore. Meanwhile, these things feel new and scary for a change. And I think showing them interact with Tess in that way means that they're different as well. They're not just mindless. And later on in episode 5, you'll see different versions of them. And I think that's important too, because it shows that they too are a kind of weird, warped society. So they're not just drones running around waiting to be killed by some grenade. I think it makes them genuinely frightening. The kiss was, yes, it was disgusting in all the right ways. It really worked for me.
Yeah, completely agree. I think there's a real sort of new terror that The Last of Us have brought to the idea of what an infected horde may be. They're not just, like you said, they're not just mindless things. They're not slow. They're not just plodding along. It's not that. This is a communicating. This is a strategizing, this is a, for the lack of a better word, an organized society of infected. I mean, if you spend any time researching the origins of the cordyceps and all that stuff, again, they're not mindless, right? The fungal takes over an ant and makes the ant do its bidding. It's not a zombie horde. It's a vehicle for new things. For the fungus, this is a fucking suit of armor, right? So there's new things that it does with it. So that idea that it does more than just want brains is really interesting. Also, I think episode 2's just setup of being outside the quarantines on the QZ is nice. I like that they got out of there pretty quickly.
The thing I'm most excited about, honestly, is that people get to watch episode 3 next week.
Oh, yeah.
I think all of this is the perfect setup going into what that is. Because once again, you get more world building, but a different side of the world that is being built. And you get more character development, but yet again, a different side of the characters that we've already seen. All of that just works so well. But episode 1 and 2 do a lot of the heavy lifting, so that it can ease you into episode 3. Now, when you sit down and watch episode 3, which is like an hour and 10 minutes, it's slightly longer than the other episodes, you're completely in for the ride. You're invested already and you're good to go. Like you said, Bahe, episode 1 showed us the inside of the quarantine zone. Episode 2 showed us the world at large. We're already familiar with Joel and Ellie and we know where their story is going. And now it's time to take a little detour. And I think, I can't wait for people to see episode 3. It's going to be so good.
Tess name drops the characters in episode 3 in this episode. I didn't catch it the first time, I think, because it was such a, I wouldn't call it a throwaway line, but it wasn't anything that they doubled down on as characters. Tess mentions the names, then they just sort of move on. And I think episode 3 will give you a real introduction to those characters and also just a real background to what everybody had to deal with. Good shows like this always make me think about what it would be like if this show was on NBC in the late 90s or even in the early 2000s, right? In the sense that what if Craig Mazin and Neil Druckmann had 23 episodes to deal with? I get why it would be such a bad show, because we've seen it done so many times. You know, we would have spent the first maybe 3 episodes in the QZ. Episode 2 could have been 2 episodes. At which point you're at episode 5, 6, which is the perfect spot where you would drop an episode 3.
You would also save every major death and plot turning point for either a mid-season cliffhanger or a season finale cliffhanger.
I haven't played the game. That's kind of the point of why I'm doing this. But like, I didn't know Tess dies. I didn't know there was a Tess, one, you know, and a Torv showing up in this show was great. And then losing her in 2 episodes was not so great, but also great.
Everything that happens here feels necessary. It's all killer, no filler. And when you're basing something off such a popular game with such a huge following, you need to make sure that everything you do, that every decision you make is warranted, that the things you cut deserve to be cut, that the things you add need to be there. And I think episode 2 is a very good example, in a nutshell, of how they balance that stuff. Episode 1 still had a lot of fan service. And you can see from the numerous websites that have done side-by-side comparisons of the shots from what we see in the game versus what we see in the show. And so in that sense, episode 1 was very smart to win the fans over. Episode 2 is them branching out on their own, putting their own spin on it, making all the necessary changes with regards to the infected. All of that stuff happens here, and it's just very, very cleverly done.
It feels like Mazin and Druckmann are using the game as touchstones, as touch points in their story. They're not adhering to the same script. They're not just pulling together the script from the game. They go, okay, so this happens. How do we get there? Okay, we can use the same way, or we can rework the same way. But the idea is that there are these touchstones and these plot points that everybody's familiar with, and they were good at the time and still are, but maybe there's a more interesting way to get there.
If you're listening to this podcast, you're obviously as invested in the show as we are. So let us know your thoughts on episode 2 of The Last of Us. You know how to reach out. All of our social media feeds are GogglerMY. If you drop us a DM on Twitter or Instagram, we will send you a link to join our brand new Discord server where we're talking about a whole bunch of things. Right now, we're talking about Oscar nominations and Marvel Snap and spoilers for The Last of Us. So jump in on that conversation. You can also email us, if you please, podcast@goggler.my, or send us an old-fashioned WhatsApp on the Goggler hotline. You don't want 2-524-5208. Thank you so much for listening. This is the Goggler Podcast.